You have entered a comic exposure reheat. Please take care to put on protective gear to avoid third-degree burns. Comic Exposure Summer Reheat event begins now.
Welcome to the Comic Exposure Podcast. My name is Josh, and with me is my 80s gritty rebooted superhero living in a different city with a bag of tricks. The one, the only.
Unlike other Robin Hoods, I speak with an English accent. Travis Ratz here.
Travis Ratz. We're back at it again. On this episode of Comic Exposure, where Travis and I dive deep into graphic novels and trades, we are in Reheat Summer, the summer reheat series that we've got going on this summer, where Travis and I, every summer, we try to go ahead and try something different, lean into some reading habits, find something new. This summer, we decided to go back and read the next chapter of some of the things we did long ago. We have read volume 2 of Preacher, going back to our second episode ever. To continue on from that, we went and we read volume 2 of Local Man, continuing on with a more recent one. And now we're going back to a time right before COVID or right during COVID. I don't remember which one. When we read Longbow Hunters, Green Arrow, Longbow Hunters, a DC sort of reboot of the Green Arrow character, taking him out of Star City, I think that's where he was at, and putting him in, is it Star City? Isn't that where he was? And putting him in Seattle, kind of changing it up, making it more gritty, making it more realistic. And this is a continuation of that story. We read the prelude a while ago. Travis, Green Arrow, do you remember anything about Longbow Hunters? Do you remember anything about it?
Again, so far I have been able to accomplish my summer reheat readings without reheating a podcast, because that was our rule, is you can't go back and read it, but you can reheat the podcast. And I was like, no, I'm like, I think I can get into it. And then I opened it up and I started like the first couple of pages, and I was like, oh, I don't remember like what the villain was of the last one. And I'm like, oh, but then things start coming back. So even in this, they do a pretty good job. Like the big thing for me was Black Canary. I was like, oh yeah, I know. I remember he's living with Black Canary now. And I remember they were in Seattle and they had a flower shop. And then they flash back to Black Canary and what happens. I'm like, oh yeah. Yeah. I remember it. And I'm sure it's what we talked about quite a bit in the podcast was that scene as being, kind of what differentiates this book from a lot of typical superhero books, especially at the time this was written, which was, what year do we have this taken?
Oh man, I want to say it's probably it's late 80s, I think.
Yeah, because I'm looking 1988.
Yeah.
Post Dark Knight Returns, post a lot of these darker superhero takes, you know, Frank Miller's Daredevil, but really still pushing the envelope here.
Right. And I think this is that, and you know, DC's, you know, you have Batman, but that wasn't in continuity, right? Like that's out of continuity. The Dark Knight Returns, that leaning into like being more mature, is not in continuity. This is in continuity. This is the story. This is Green Arrow for 70 some issues. This is Green Arrow for 9 volumes, is this sort of grounded take on Green Arrow. And to me, that goes like, you can't do that with Superman. You can't spend 9 volumes doing that with Batman or the Flash or Wonder Woman. Green Arrow is the character where you go like, well, we're going to set him outside the rest of superheroes.
Yeah.
He's not really going to interact with anybody.
Yeah. It's called Black Label. This is a Black Label book before Black Label.
Yes. This is very Vertigo too, right? Like this feels very like, hey, Constantine Vertigo or Swamp Thing Vertigo that we're telling with this. I think
maybe not as far as that, but about to be far. Yeah,
this is literally on every issue. It says like new format for mature audiences, right? Mm-hmm. Like it clearly says on the book covers, like new format, mature audiences. Don't read this looking for arrows with boxing gloves on the end of them. You're not like, that's
this
not
ain't this, Ollie Quinn. This ain't Ollie Quinn. This is Oliver Quinn.
This is Oliver Quinn, sir. So I, you know, we had read this, like I said, I believe it was either just before COVID or at the beginning of COVID.
I think right at the beginning stages of it. Because I remember sitting on my couch, like in the middle, I think I just finished virtual teaching and we had done like Fables, I think when it started, and this is with along with Fables because we were reading longer books because we had time on our hands and we were podcasting the Wazoo. And I remember sitting on my couch, like maybe like the second week of COVID, being like, well, this is kind of nice.
Right.
This is kind of nice to have some time to read a long form 80s comic book and not have to, you know, grade papers in between, and how wrong I was.
Yeah. During, I have read this entire 9-volume run. This was my COVID obsession. Like reading this, I reread Batman Nightfall, I think, right before that, and it kind of leaned into the beginning of it. And then I read this, and two things were happening during that long stretch of COVID when school was weird. I was reading Green Arrow, you know, the James Grell Green Arrow, and I was building little robot models. Those are the two things that I did. This is my book.
You turned into a 16-year-old.
I did. I own.
You're like a Weezer song. You're like, I'm reading Green Arrow. I'm building lots of toys. My wife, she's annoyed.
And for me, this is something I own digitally. I own issues 1 through 33. This is my hunt book. This is the book I hunt for when I'm out at cons or whatever. Issues 1 through 33 in single issues. And then you, for Christmas, bought me the first omnibus. So I have the volume, I have omnibus volume 1 in this. I own this in 3 formats. It makes no sense. If I could find readily the volumes in paperback, I would probably own those as well. Like, I can't explain.
Actually, this
why.
Wouldn't be a bad story to tell in paperback. No, not comic, but like,
right.
Like a pulp novel.
Yes, if it's very pulpy. So let's get into it, Travis. You said you didn't remember much about Longbow Hunters. You started this. It gets going. Talk to me a little bit about what you thought of this jumping in clean. Because you got to think about it. You read Longbow Hunters. You don't really remember all of it. But talk to me about where are you at when you're reading them. What do you think about this take on a hero?
Yeah, so sitting down, and I opened up my digital reader and scrolled through all the preliminary stuff, and I get to the first page, and then it all came back to me. Because I was like, I know I talked positively about the book, but did I like the book? I know Josh really loved the book, but like, how did I feel about it? Was it just like, hey, we were reading a lot of comics on here? And then I read the first opening panels on here. I'm going to give you a little sample reading of it here for the audience. They call it a hunter's moon. Silver light stirs an ancient part of our soul, a dim half-forgotten dream of what we all were, pulse quickening in the anticipation. You prowl the moonlit forest, taking a small step backward to the simpler, sweeter, more savage time. And I said, oh yeah, I liked it. I remember now why I liked that first book. And I was like, okay, we're good. I was like, buckle up, we're in for a ride. Once I got that overdub narration, I was like, oh yeah, this is right in the sweet spot for me, baby. And then it was all downhill from there. It was easy cruising through it, man.
It does feel, you mentioned this early on, it feels Frank Miller-y, right? It feels, you know, those narration points in Dark Knight and in
Watchmen,
Daredevil,
especially with
and in Watchmen.
Rorschach. The blood of the city washes away down the sewers, the scum.
Right? But it is very much, you can see James Grell is like, hell yeah, this I'm going to do this. We're going to make this happen. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lean in. We're going to tell this story. It's going to look gritty. It's going to sound gritty. It's not going to be Superman. You're not going to pick up Flash and see this. We're going to do a street level character without superpowers, and we're just going to tell this sort of this tale. We're going to tell this noir-y, pulpy, detective-y story, and lean into it. And for me, that I think is what really got me reading this again, was like, oh man, I forgot. Like, I read all of this, right? And I reread the prelude to this probably about a year ago again. Like, oh, I'm gonna read that one again. But I hadn't read volume one again since I read it that very first time. And man, he just does a great job of telling this sort of like pulpy, gritty, dark tale without going too dark, but you can feel the 80s in it. There are some things I'm like, oh, I don't think someone would write it like that.
We're gonna talk about that when we get to the storyline. There's that one storyline where you're like, wow, this was pretty brave. Now, so you talked about that pulpy thing, and I think we had read some pulp books before we read the first volume of this. But now, since we had read volume one, we have definitely put our foot into the pulp world with Brubaker and some of the other books that have been really pulpy. So it's very easy to recognize Grell, like you said, going down this world. And there's a couple of things that stand out. One, you know, if you're going to be a pulp detective, you've got to have the weird front for your business, right? Whether it's a movie theater or a comic book shop, or what was the one we just read? A couple of Human Target. What was his? Like, he lived on top of like a pizza place.
An Italian restaurant.
So Oliver's got the flower shop, Sherwood Flowers, or something like that. So you're like pulpy. Sherwood Flores, of course. So you got like weird detective front. Ooh, thumbs up.
I don't know who gave
and oh, me. When you do this, it realizes it.
Oh,
you don't have a cool MacBook thing, so
I know.
So that was it. All right, you have somewhat of femme fatales, right? We have these victims that come in and on there. You have the not afraid, don't want to do violence, don't want to kill, but will if have to, right? That every pulp detective has to struggle with. And then, you know, of course, the inability to stand by as innocents are and just a nice little peppering of sexuality in there, some sexual
just enough
issues.
Right. Think this first issues on this, where we're following this killer, this child like torturer, right? How gritty can we get? He's been released on prison, he's getting a retrial, he's rich, and then the girl that he did this to is now a woman, and she's getting these calls. Someone's after her. Is it a copycat? Is it the same guy? What's going on? Who's the only man who can stop it? Green Arrow. The pulp is like the narration, his narration is so Frank Miller. It is so Watchmen. Like Grell, reading this, I'm like, oh, they're right next to each other, man. I you know, you can talk about whether he's aping it or not, or what it is, but I think he's writing in a way that very much is on parallel with the dialogue and the sort of, you know, that narration that you get in both of those books, right? Like, this isn't a mud pit, it's an operating table, right? Like,
they just took from like the 1950s and 60s pulp paperback novels. So it's not Frank Miller invented that dialogue, you know?
Right.
And one of the things that in searching for it, this was actually for free on Kindle Reader. And so when I went in to find the book, I was like, I could probably just shortcut it by putting in Green Arrow Volume 1, because you didn't give me the title of the actual volume. Scroll, Green Arrow Volume 1, Kevin Smith, Green Arrow Volume 1, this, Green Arrow Volume 1, this. I mean, I had to put in Grell for even to pop up on my thing. And I was like, how is that possible? How is this not like, you know, when you put in Batman Dark Knight, Frank Miller pops up, right? Or Batman, you know, whatever it is. I don't understand how like algorithms, I know how algorithms work, which means in my head that this isn't being downloaded as much. It's not being bought as much as some of these other Green Arrow runs. And I was like, how can that be? How is this not being talked about more in not like the deep, deep comic circles, but, you know, comic book readers, even our age, no one mentions this. You know, you get the Grant Morrisons, you get the Frank Millers, you get the Mark Miller, Millers and stuff like that, but you don't get Grell.
Yeah, I think I said James, and it's Mike, and so I'm just going to correct myself for that. So Mike Grell, this run on this, I'm just curious, like, what was the thing that doesn't put this on that level? And I wonder if it's because it's so long form, right? When you think of Dark Knight, it's short. You can read it in one piece. When you think of Watchmen, it's 12 issues. It's done. When you think, I guess Daredevil is that other piece of it, but people aren't reading that giant run of Miller's Daredevil, right? Like you and I, we read that first big giant chunk of it, and it doesn't get good right away, right? Like you don't get him, you don't get Frank Miller really doing it right off the bat. I feel like this is on that level with me, and you're right. I don't see it in that space. Being as prevalent.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking up Grell here. It says he's worked on characters such as Aquaman, Batman, Green Arrow, of course, Phantom Stranger. He's created some original characters. The Warlord is a DC book and best creator known character. That I think we need to check out, just looking at the art of Warlord there.
Yeah.
He did some Tarzan. Grell wrote and drew Tarzan comic strip for a while. He did John Sable freelance. So he did like another detective thing. Like I'm looking at this right now. The character was heavily influenced by Ian Fleming's James Bond. Like why did I know that, Josh? Why haven't I read, you know, Sable freelance for Christ's sakes? You know, like it's got all the stuff that I want in a character, and if you put Grell's writing on it, I'm gonna read this tonight, Josh.
I don't know what it is, and like I said, I wonder if it's the long form story of this, and that's why I wonder if like he didn't do anything major after this, right? Like he's in this blip of time doing a character that isn't very big, but when I think of like the CW Green Arrow, right? That was this big giant hit. That's this Green Arrow. This is the Hood, right? That is this Green Arrow. And, you know, there's some of those more modern pieces in it, but that's a gritty street level, like take on it that feels very much like, oh, that's this, right? But still, this is not that big thing, you know?
Yeah, so I want to talk about some of these stories here, because we kind of talked about the character, I'm sure, in our Volume 1 episode. So let's talk about specifically what he goes through here. So I actually really liked all these arcs, and he kind of does like two-issue arcs, and then the two-issue arc and two-issue arc, right? And then there's some loose stuff holding it together. So that first one was really strong. And what I think what he's really great at in these arcs are creating cool villains, man. Like creating, like you said, these street level villains where it's not like, oh, I mean, none of them have superpowers.
Right.
There's not one superpower in this entire six issues, which I love. There's not even a visit. There's not a cameo for Aquaman who's like, and it could have easily been done in arc two where they're like on an island and there's water and there's submarines. You can have the Ex Machina of Aquaman come in and be like, oh, when you fell off the cliff, Aquaman came and saved you. He doesn't do that. And he gets him beat up. These villains beat the hell out of Ollie. Yes. Even the street level thugs, even the ones that like, it's just like 4-on-1. Like 4-on-1 is enough to get Ollie beat up if it's just a regular street level thug.
Yeah. Which I think is, I think one of those things is it makes the stakes feel bigger, right? Like it literally is. He doesn't have the armor of Batman. He doesn't have the gadgets. We've taken away all of his fancy, you know, those kind of Bronze Age or Golden Age arrows and just said, hey, you're just a dude. And this is what it looks like. And the whole, it is such a, I love like that there, this is essentially two stories, right? The first story being the, how do I capture the, you know, how do I get this guy who's out of prison from hurting anybody? And then the other one is like, I've got to go up against this agent and find this virus before anybody else does. Right. And that is so pulpy and so like, let's put him on an island. Like, let's just go put him in the wilderness and have him go up against somebody. It's such a sort of like.
And then the third one is like him against like pimps and drug dealers. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. The pimps and drug dealers one. And it feels so like, I don't know. It is such a like, let's take him out of anything that would even show that he's a superhero. He's just a dude who like with a bow and arrow. He's like Rambo, right? Like just out there doing it. And you know, instead of having the exploding arrow, no, here's what I need you to do. We're going to make Molotov cocktails. That's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. Like all of this stuff just to fake it feel very real is what I think is really an interesting way to run this. And again, the micro agent to make sure the Chinese or the Russians don't get it first is very 80s.
Especially the China stuff. We don't even name countries anymore. It's like terrorist. Now, is the in the second arc here, like you said, where he has to go and kind of find this virus? Is the guy he's up against? Is that the guy from the first the prelude? I think so because he talked about leaving him on Mount Rainier and Rainier, thank you. And I was like, oh, I remember that kind of set piece because there was that big snow thing and he had a sniper rifle. And so I have a feeling, Josh, and don't tell me because I'm gonna continue reading. But this guy is kind of like the come in and come out villain of this arc, like his Moriarty.
And not even like a villain, right? Like just like his foil, right? A continual kind of like, who can I match? Who can I play chess against?
Moriarty.
Right?
Yeah.
For sure. And so I really like, cause I was curious, are we going to harken back to that? What are we going to do? Are we going to go back and lean into that first three issues? Cause really you may not have read Longbow Hunters. Right. And so I really do appreciate, you had mentioned it earlier that it goes like, hey, this is what happened. We're going to do this flashback and we're going to show you what happened to, you know, Black Canary. And we're going to,
which doesn't do it justice, by the way. No, it's not as brutal in the flashbacks.
No, but I think like, I appreciate that B plot of this volume a whole lot too. That idea of like, how are they connecting and how are they getting back together? How is she getting past that, not getting over it, right? Cause it's there, but moving past that traumatic event to like, go like, no, I want to kick ass too. And you see her do that. And you know, all of these pieces and you're like, okay, I'm like, that B plot is a really good understory in all of this too. That story.
Yeah. And I don't know much about the Black Canary. I don't know much about that character. I haven't read a lot of stuff in it. So this is kind of like, when I think of Black Canary, I think of it, her from the Grell stuff that I've read, the two volumes of Grell stuff in here. I'd like to see her take on a little bit more of a role maybe in some of Ollie's adventures that might happen, I'm guessing, along the way. Right now, I think Ollie is struggling after what happened with her. He's kind of struggling with like, hey, I don't want you helping me out because I can't control myself if something bad happens to you again. Like I will do bad things if you get put into danger, right? Which is that superhero, kind of masculine problem of like, hey, it's my job to protect the women. But it's, they present it in a way where it's like, no, he's struggling and he knows that she's capable of stuff. There's a great scene where I think it's maybe like four issues in, where she stops a bunch of thugs on the bus and she comes back home and her face is just swollen and black and blue.
Yeah.
And he's like, what happened? Tell me. And he's like, she's like, I handle it. And I've never felt so myself before. Yeah.
Like, you should have seen the other guy, and right? Like,
we love. Yeah.
And it is, but that's what this is. This is like, this leans into all of those 80s things. And I think the one, look, let's talk about it. The troublesome piece is the last arc, which is sort of like the gang and drugs arc, right? And you get Green Arrow beating up a room full of, you know, gangsters, of black gang members, right?
Josh, not only that, you get Green Arrow, like a scene from Pacino's Cruising, wearing chaps in his jeans.
Yes.
Walking down the street being bait in like the most 80s cliche, like Police Academy Blue Oyster Club scene of it. And you're like, oh, this is, we have one image of this culture in our pop media at this time.
Yes. And I will, that's the thing where like he is riding the line in this of like, but this is, again, it's that 80s pulpy thing. We read it. So we read Miss Tree, right? And again, an 80s gritty detective story, right? That leans into that. And one of the issues that we didn't read that I read after the fact deals with abortion and deals with sort of like that piece of it. And it's like, these guys who are writing this stuff are like, we want to talk about real topics. We want to talk about real things. We want to make it real. But I don't know that they were the people to write about it, or they didn't ask enough information to lean into figuring out what it was about, right? You've got white guys writing on these topics, and maybe they're not the best person to write about it, but they're leaning into like, okay, let's talk about what's going on. And instead of it having being aliens, what are the things that we can fight against, right? Like, hey, these guys are beating up homosexuals. So he's like, nah, dude, I'm going to stop this. That's not all right. We don't do that. Right.
Yeah.
So it's not the best way to portray that, but the idea of like, no, these are serious. These are crimes. You know, people are being hurt. So I'm going to solve it. I'm the guy who's going to do that.
Yeah. You know? And he even brings more complexity to it, because the gang member kind of went off on his own, and it's so creepy that they were using kids and that was their initiation. So it had nothing to do with like that. But the guy who was in charge of it was like, they go into the idea that he was homophobic because he was in prison.
Yeah.
And, you know, like he suffered sexual abuse in prison. So, and then that was the whole thing where he's like, and I got AIDS, they're killing me. I'm like, oh, okay, we're kind of enforcing things here, but like, you know, there's a sense of like, they're trying to give it more dimension and trying to show the complexity of these issues at the time.
Yeah.
Right. They were being much more fair and open in their dialogue, even if they're limited by their gender and race, than a lot of creators were at the time.
Right. And I, you know, and again, it's this sort of like, government corruption meets drugs, meets homophobia, meets all of these things. And you plunk down. I think that's the thing I think is the most interesting is, you know, we talk about, and I think about, like, part of the reason I appreciate, you know, we just read Tom King. And one of the reasons I think I appreciate Tom King is Tom King takes these superheroes, these goofy things, and says, like, let's throw them into real life. Right. And it's part of that is, you know, superhero real life. But I think that's why I enjoy that. And the reason I enjoy this book is that idea of like, let's lean into a superhero in real life, and not even a superhero. He's just a hero. He doesn't have any superpowers. Like, he's not super, he's just a dude.
Yeah.
And who gets his ass kicked, right? Like, for sure.
So I want to talk about the art, because I read this digitally and I was like, oh, you know, it's an old comic book. It might be nice to get some floppies of it, or like it's one of your favorites. So of course you just, you know, collect it. But I was like, I really enjoyed reading this digitally because the colors just really pop on there. They're not muted by time the way that some trades are, especially on certain papers on there. And so, I mean, some of these colors are just gorgeous, and they really, the digital reader really draws attention to some of these pinks and greens that kind of populate this. And there are really some creative character constructions. They're always kind of finding cool stuff to do with the arrow and the perspective of the arrow, like what it's being, if it's being shot through a flame. I really like how in several different panels, they will show Oliver doing the drawing the arrow and pulling the arrow, and they'll do it in kind of shadowed solid colors on there. That's really cool. Anytime I see that. So I really like the character designs in here. I like how they, he puts time into the fashion of the other characters.
Yes. I think that's one of the, but I think that's the great piece of this is like, nobody is wearing the same outfit. Right. They all feel very like he's like, okay, I want, these people are going to be wearing real clothes. How do we do that? How do we draw that? One of the things you'll notice is that the coloring really changes on issues 5 and 6. Like the line work is narrower. The coloring is different. It's a little more vibrant. That is from that point on, you get a lot more like big neon yellow backgrounds, pinks and oranges that carry through the series, like the purples and stuff. And I don't, you know, it's, I don't know where it comes from, but that is very much like, okay, let's lean into this sort of 80s neon color palette, right? Like it, like even feels 80s, just those colors.
One of the things that I saw here, thinking of the fashions, there's this panel where Black Canary is just in like a man's shirt, and it's like pink and white stripes. And I was like, well, obviously that's Ollie's shirt. I can't imagine him with his blonde goatee and his long blonde locks, then throwing on this pink and white striped shirt and like avoiding detection. I'm just like, is that like, I guess maybe she's wearing it because it's like deep in his closet, like it was a gift. And so he's like, she's like, oh, I like it if you're not going to wear it. But
it is very much like, it is very 80s though, right? You can see him like with some high-waisted jeans rocking that thing, 3 buttons undone. You know what I mean?
And I also love how they're really like adamant about like you carry out what you carry in. In the second arc, he has to take a boat, a ferry, to get to this island. And he's on there. And he's got his gear bag in his gym. And then he has like almost like a pool cue type thing where his arrows and stuff can be. And it's in every, it doesn't come out of nowhere. Like you see him, like he's checking onto the boat with it. He's having a conversation with all his gear. And I love that. I love the fact that like, you're not just going to walk on with an exposed bow and arrow. And like, you do have to have something that's functional to carry it in, and we got to draw it. So there it is.
I like, that's one of the things I think, like I said, there's so many things that make this run grounded and this arc grounded. You know, you're playing with 3 very sort of 80s things, right? And this first volume, these first, you know, 6 issues, and that continues on, and it ends up being, it feels very like he takes trips a lot. Like that's really this whole Green Arrow run is like, I don't know, man, take him to Alaska. He's got to go find something in Alaska. Go do that. Right. he's got to go here. Go take him there. You know, you see him sort of like be this man of mystery. Like the government keeps roping him into some of these things. And I think it's a really interesting way to tell this story and have it not be, hey, the Justice League needs you to do this. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
and I'm so glad they didn't pop in.
And I think there's one time as I read all these 9 volumes where the Green Lantern shows up. But it is the least.
Okay, but they're road trip pals.
Right. And so there's no like, it's not like he saves him. It's literally like, Ollie, what the hell's going on, dude? What's wrong with you? Like, he comes to visit him to kind of like see if he's okay. Like, that's what it is. It's not like, I got saved by the Green Lantern because I couldn't get out of this pickle, right? It ends up being like, you know, Hal Jordan being like, what the hell's wrong with you, man? Like, are you okay? Like, that's what this thing is about.
Like, I hear you're like, you're kind of like killing people now. And yeah. Like,
are you okay, man? Like, what's going on?
Oh, but, and they show Seattle. Like, Seattle becomes like a real part of this story. Like, the opening issue, there's a whole like kind of set piece, or not set piece, but the reference to like the Space Needle, and they show that. He talks about how Seattle is kind of a weird mix of like, it's just big enough to have crime, but it also has like art and life, like in New York City. I mean, there's a lot of Seattle shout out in there. And it's not just like, it's Seattle and then we never mention it again. It's very much Seattle based, which is cool.
It feels very much like and that's why I think, like, to me, this is a very Marvel Comics DC comic, right? It takes place in a real city. It's got ground level things. It's dealing with real issues in a way that I think you saw, you know, like it or not, the way Punisher dealt with things, the way that Daredevil deals with things in Hell's Kitchen, the way that, you know, you've got Power Man and all these, you know, all these things, where they're ground level and surface level and they deal with the real city, you're getting that with a DC character, which is usually gods and monsters, right? Like, that's what DC is. And you're not getting that. And I don't know if that's why I love this book so much or what it is, because it's the least DC book. But there's just something about, you know, this run that I was just like, okay, I'm in. This is it. It's like, you know, Beverly Hills Cop meets 48 Hours, like all of these 80s. I'm waiting for Eddie Murphy to show up and like be his partner in one of these stories, right? Like, that's what it feels like in all of these issues, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm gonna keep reading it. I'm actually looking up right now. The John Sable stuff you can't get digitally. Of course. It's kind of expensive. $43 a handbook. So let's see. The second. Yeah, so I'm actually probably going to start reading the second one tonight, or the second volume tonight, because I want to see kind of what happens in it. And it's nice because there are kind of these little two arcs, so you can kind of sit down. You don't have to devote like an hour to reading it. You just kind of can pick at it.
Yeah.
You said there's how many volumes?
9 volumes. So 9 volumes, what is that? It's, you know, almost, it's probably when it's all done, it's like 70 issues or something like that. 70
something issues, yeah.
Yeah. So, great stuff. It's one of my favorites. And I'm glad that you didn't hate it, Travis, because that's what I'm worried that we'd read it and you'd be like, oh, I don't know, man. Why does Josh like this?
No. Week? Yeah. Yeah. I kind of came into it thinking like, oh, I might not like this as much as he did. But then I read that first page and that would be my only thing is I like that. I would like some more over narration to it because it's done so well here.
He does.
It kind of usually starts off the issue and then he kind of drops it as issues go on.
Yeah, there's like the one where he's hunting in that very first volume where he's like going after the killer and he's like heart shot, falls like a brick. Like as he like shoots the guy who's like hanging onto the thing, like the serial killer, or like the rapist or whatever.
Yeah. Like, and they show the arrow all bent up.
Yeah, and like, but that those two lines, like heart shot, falls like a brick. That's so Dark Knight. It's I don't know. I think.
The cop was like, let's say that it wasn't him, and like you just shot some kid and killed him. What would you say? The cop was like, hey, listen, we appreciate the help, but what happens? You said you like shot him and he didn't die. That's an issue for us.
Yes. It's a very, I like that. Like he's got to work with the cops and he's got to, you know, like the detective and all of that's really interesting. I do love just grounding these characters in this real world and just kind of having fun with it. So Travis, art's great. Writing's great. This is one of my favorites. I'm glad we got to reheat it. Folks, you can find all the episodes over at comicexposure.com. Thank you for tuning in. Travis, what are we reading next, man? What's our, bless you. We didn't talk. What's our next book, dude?
Let's do Animosity.
All right. So Animosity is the next book. We read volume one a while ago. We're reading volume two. I just remember that animals can talk. That's what I get. That's all I remember. The animals have taken over. And I don't remember why. But I'm not going to reheat. I'm going to go in blind, Travis. Like when you
go to the supermarket. Yeah, and sometimes some books will give you like a little recap.
Let's see what happens. All right, folks, you can find us on the internet. Like I said, comicsposure.com. Next book we'll do for our reheat summer is Animosity. Get ready for that. And Travis and I will see you next trade.